This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, joined as always by my friend Bradley Chambers. Tonight we got one sponsor for the show, our good friends at Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite device management system for Macs and iOS devices. We'll tell you more about them as the show goes on, but if you want to hear more from them just now, you can visit them at jamfsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com, and we'll tell you more later on. Good evening, Bradley. How are you?
I am fantastic, Fraser. How about yourself?
I'm not too bad. I've been travelling. I've been to London and back over the course of this week for the Apple Leadership Summit, I believe it's called. Their big event that goes around the Bet Show at London. I mentioned it in the last show as well. So we had a good time there. Met a few podcast listeners. So hello to everybody who very kindly came up and said that they enjoyed the show. That was really nice. And heard some stories about schools using iOS devices.
And if you're playing along at home on the Out of School beverage game, every time Fraser says he travels this week, you must now take a drink.
Yeah, it's been a quiet time. Christmas in early January is always a quiet time, but this is the sort of first event of the new year, always. So, yeah, we had a good time.
It's always fun. Conferences are great. But and going to sessions are great, but I get so much out of like just the hanging out with other peers and just talking about situations. It's almost like you just want to go and just not have any sessions and just meet up for dinner and just talk things out and have roundtable sessions.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the sort of added values in a world where most people interact with people far away from the, you know, I mean, we all obviously work in schools and so on, but you know, sometimes you might be the only subject teacher in your school.
Right.
And it's good to meet people elsewhere as well, as I am. So, yeah, the leadership summit was interesting. We got pitches from Apple about the stuff that they do for education. Nothing particularly new there. It was just, you know, the focus was, again, you know, iPad, iTunes U, iBooks Author, the App Store, and the iBook Store. You know, the kind of things that we've heard for a while. And I suppose what they're trying to do is they're trying to tell more people about it. So get different people, newer people in through the door and hear that story. But then there was other sessions where we went and the schools had come along and they were putting on kind of training sessions for people to show ideas and different things that they'd done. So it was interesting to see what people are doing and what people are thinking about as well.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge for Apple, particularly in education, is because you know, even looking back in the fall at the new APIs and the managed distribution things you can do with iOS 7, mm-hmm. you know us that are on the ground floor, we're ready for the next big news. And Apple's still trying to effectively communicate the changes to the rest of the people that aren't, you know, kind of don't keep their ears to the ground. So there's a balancing act for Apple there to move, to be innovative, but also to, you know, bring all their customers along. You know, it's tough. They've got a tough job there.
Yeah. I think one of the things I particularly enjoyed at the event was there were sort of hands-on sessions, and then there was case studies by individual schools. And in the past, I've done such presentations at that event, but there was different schools this time. And what I liked about that was there was an increased focus on school leadership and the role of school leadership in large one-to-one deployments, that it wasn't just about anymore kind of here's a thing you can do with an iPad, because that I think even people who are walking in off the street and haven't ever thought about using the iPad in education, they at least have some cultural awareness of the idea that an iPad can do X, Y, or Z. You know, you can draw on an iPad, you can make music on an iPad or whatever. And it was good to see them bringing to the fore the focus on leadership and planning and organization, because I think that's something that, you know, in some of the stories I hear, I'm not so sure that a lot of iPad deployments are anything but opportunistic, based on finding a pot of money or carving out some money this year from something or other, and we get some iPads and that's just got a deployment. But in fact, for long-term sustainable culture change in the school, leadership's actually much more important than any technical aspect you could talk about.
Yeah, I agree there. And it just goes back to proper planning and a deployment is the keys to success. I mean, obviously it matters what apps you use. That obviously that matters in some ways. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have all the apps on day one, that doesn't sideline your deployment. But if you don't have proper leadership at the top of your deployment driving the thing forward, when the occasional bumps do hit, then the whole thing can fall apart. You just need somebody, you know, yep. I think at Apple they call them the DRI, the directly responsible individual. And I think mm-hmm. every deployment needs that, that at the end of the day, this person can either answer any question, you know, a student, a parent, or another teacher might have, or they know where to find it.
Yeah. That's one thing that I talk a lot about when I do kind of training with schools, school leadership in that respect, is that there are questions that have to be answered. And it's not that I can tell you what the answer should be, but you have to have an answer for that question. You know, the question about who's responsible when it gets damaged, simplest possible question, the first one you'll probably get. You can answer that several different ways, but you can't not have an answer. And one of the things that I try and do is push school leaders to think about, you know, what is your answer going to be to the damage question? What about e-safety? What about this? What about that? What about that? And it's crucial because you see sometimes, you know, a scandal hits or something and the deployment kind of gets rolled back or shut down or something because people didn't have an answer for it and they didn't anticipate the questioning and the line of inquiry that they were going to get. So that's important.
When iPads, we were first beginning to look at them in education, the focus on was how easy the device is for the end user. And that's still certainly true. But in some ways, deployments, planning through them can be more complicated on iOS because of the difference in the application licensing, the way you manage media, the fact that Apple views the user as the king. In some ways, it can make it more difficult than, say, a Mac deployment where you can just lock the thing down. You can buy, you get your apps from Microsoft and you get them from Adobe or whoever, and you have a volume license key and you just install them through your MDM and you're done. And with iOS, there's not always one single answer on the best practices. A lot of it depends on your environment and really what your ultimate goal is. So, although it's still easy for the end user, iOS, you have to think through that. And not everyone has the answers. There's no perfect consultant for this because it's we're just into this year four.
I disagree. I am the perfect consultant.
Show's over. Podcast show's is over. Yeah, we're Mic done. Drop.
No, I agree, and I think, you know, in some ways, what I feel like I see with a lot of beginning schools who are thinking about iPad is that they sort of have this notion that because, you know, maybe the head teacher or senior teacher went to the Apple store on a Saturday and got themselves an iPad and was blown away by how easy it was to set up and how helpful the people were at the store, that they're just going to do that 500 times and they're done. And I think what is kind of not missing, but it is sort of is known by some people and not broadly shared, is the idea that there is a method of professional iOS deployment. And there are factors to be considered beyond those factors that you would consider if you were just buying a personal iPad. And in some ways, when we started in 2010, that's what we did. Is we just took our personal experience of iPad and multiplied it up by 100 or whatever. And I think when you look at some of the things that have happened in the back end with Apple over the past kind of year and a half to do with iOS deployment, a lot of it has been focused on scaling the size of a deployment. So in 2010, you could probably do about 100 to 150 devices without losing your mind. And then a couple of years later, you could probably do 300 or 400, 500. And then we were seeing deployments up to 1,000, 2,000. And now we're seeing deployments up to five figures in size. And I think, I suppose one of the key goals appears to be, I have no inside information, but one of the key goals appears to be as massively scalable as you can. So it is conceivable that you could do 600,000 students in a school district with iOS, with some kind of cogent deployment method, with a team managing it and making it run properly. And that's a challenge, and I think it's a worthy challenge to take on. I suppose it's in contrast a little bit to what you see with like Google Play, for example, where they're talking about individual teachers going into the store and spending credit, which is not how a big deployment really runs. And I think there's sort of all this hidden stuff that people have to think about as well. And that information is sort of known, but also very much not known. And I'm not sure that there's enough people around right now to help schools through that and really talk to them about what all those things are and what kinds of answers you could give, as well as providing case studies, I suppose, of actual answers as well, positive and negative.
No, I agree. It's simple and it's complicated all in the same breath.
Yes, and I kind of feel like iOS deployment is sort of semi-professionalized now, in that there are tools for it, but there's not really a very large body of experience. Does that make sense? I mean, Linux deployments, there's all kinds of tools and loads of people know how to do it, and there's like conferences on how to deploy large-scale Linux systems and so on. But there's not really that for iOS. I mean, our sponsors, Jamf, they have the Jamf Nation User Conference, and there's some good content comes out of that for Mac and iOS. But there's not, I feel like there's not a reference body of work about iOS deployment yet.
Well, and it changes so quickly. If you look at the way you deploy Mac OS over the past 3 years, it's changed slightly. And obviously you've thrown in the App Store and some things like that. But how you deployed iPads in 2011 versus how you deploy them in the fall of 2014 are night and day differently. And so, you know, like if we wrote a book today, how to deploy iOS, it could be out of date in 6 months.
Yeah. That's the challenge. That is the challenge. And the problem is that, you know, in some ways, like, your deployment goes on for a long time. So deployments have a life cycle, or should have. Some deployments don't. They're just opportunistic, like I said. But, you know, if you're doing it properly, your deployment has a life cycle and a cadence to it. And you've got summer holidays where you can make certain changes, and, you know, refreshes where you can make even bigger changes, and you change the hardware and so on. And I think at the moment, you know, We've kind of been adapting what is not essentially, but actually just consumer technology and bringing it into school. And I'm not arguing for an enterprise iPad, but I'm hinting at the possibility that it might be valuable for both sides, both Apple and customers, to have a little bit more of a roadmap about where some of this is going. And I think, you know, we don't need to see you screenshots of the next operating system. You can keep the headline news to yourself, but I think for things like managed distribution and various other parts of the kind of IT deployment ecosystem, it's kind of to its detriment that WWDC doesn't have an IT track anymore, because that was one of the places where people could go and find out a lot of that stuff. So, yes, there was one or two sessions, I think, about enterprise deployment of iOS devices this year at the conference, but I think... You know, those days when Apple gave it a roadmap for iOS software, I think it would be nice to see something like that come back again.
Well, and I know Apple has their release schedules, but it would be helpful for us for something like managed distribution to come out, to be announced in the spring, be available mid-May. And so as you're planning new deployments for the fall, it'd be available. And the way it is now, when the new stuff comes out in October, your deployments are already started.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing that has really been to education's detriment over the past sort of 18 months is the ever-increasing focus on Christmas for Apple sales and Apple product planning as well. You know, all the phones, all the tablets all come out in October, November for Christmas. And then, you know, schools have just bought. I mean, we just bought a couple of months before the iPad Air. I mean, would have been very beneficial to us if we could have got iPad Airs into our school for the next few years rather than fourth generation iPads. But it is what it is. And, you know, in education buying, you've just got to buy whatever's current in July and hope for the best.
Yes.
I guess that's it.
Well, let's take a quick sponsor break before we move on and thank the fine folks at Jamf Software. Of course, they've been with us for many weeks now. You guys know they provide the... best-in-class tools for IT staff to manage Apple technologies in education and enterprise environments. This includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs. Their Casper Focus app is built for teachers and allows teachers, not IT staff, to quickly focus students' attention on iPads, conduct secure exams within an app. Again, this is using the Guided Access API. select the specific Apple TVs assigned to the class, choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even prompt AirPlay. Big fans of Jamf. Learn more about them at jampsoftware.com. Also, they're on Twitter at jampsoftware. Of course, we've talked about them in many shows in the past, and I'll put a link to a couple of those shows in the show notes if you want to hear more about them. I had an email from a listener this week asking, you know, talking about MDM, and you know, as we said, the one of the core competencies for one-to-one deployments today is MDM. And I think you'll find no better partner than the Apple-focused Jamf software. So thanks for, to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week.
Most definitely. I spoke to some people at the Apple event who had been to see Jamf at the Bet Show, which is kind of runs just consecutively with the Apple show. And apparently they were showing off Casper 9.3. I don't think I'm talking out of school here because as far as I know, they were showing it publicly. And apparently that is a release that has managed distribution support in it, which would be very nice.
Well, and see, that's the thing, you know, I think we've mentioned that picking the right MDM vendor is key, because if you want somebody that's not going to take a year and a half to implement new APIs, you know, that's that I had, you know, I was tweeting this morning that my printer vendor had new macOS 9 drivers in 2011. But they actually, like, literally a couple of days ago released Mavericks drivers.
Well, that's nothing. I was using a textbook this week, which was published in 2013, which made reference to AppleWorks.
Well, we can't have nice things.
It was 10 years and 2 days to the day that AppleWorks was last updated with a maintenance release, not even with an actual feature release, when we were using that textbook.
Yeah, this is why we can't have nice
things. To the shame of, you know, shame on everybody for that being a thing that happened. So, anyway, enough about that.
Yeah. So, what are we talking about this week?
Well, parental controls are in the news again. Apple getting a good slap on the wrist from the FTC for unauthorized charges. Well, yeah, I suppose unauthorized charges. That kids have made through in-app purchase. And the claim essentially was that Apple did not properly inform people of the existence of the 15-minute purchase window when you put in your password the first time. So it's actually, you know, my first reaction to this was, you know, Apple takes a $32 million charge because parents suck. You know, with the kind of attitude that, well, you should be being a bit more careful about that than just typing in your password whenever your kid asks you to. And I still think that's true. But the FTC complaint is very specific against what Apple had done. And I'm just going to quote from a Reuters article that quotes one of the people from the FTC. And it says, to be clear, the issue is not that Apple opens a 15-minute window for in-app purchases. What we challenge is the fact that Apple does not inform users of the existence of the window. When parents enter a password, they do not know the full scope of charges they could incur, end quote. And I think that's fair. You know, I think there's a lot of, not a lot, but there are some behaviors in iOS that are pretty poorly kind of explained. And I think that's one of them. And it's interesting to note that if you look on iOS 7, when you put in the password for an in-app purchase, there is an additional purchase confirmation step right after that. So it's interesting to see that they took that hit. You know, Tim Cook was quoted as not being very happy about this, and of course they're not very happy about it. I'm sure they've got to say that anyway. But you know, $32.5 million is only barely even a slap on the wrist for Apple compared to you know, they must make that in a few seconds of sales. Do you get a lot of chat about in-app purchase, Bradley?
I did a few years ago. I don't as much now. But yeah, a few years ago, I would have you know, phone calls and emails and pop-ins from parents, and you know, they'd say, "Yeah, my kid spent $15 and didn't even really know it." Of course, they were you know, talking about. It. I said, look, in retrospect, thankfully the games are cheap and they're not $60 PlayStation games that they're buying without your knowledge. But yeah, I don't get that as much anymore, and I don't know if it being in the news so much around that time, you know, kind of prompted parents to change their Apple ID passwords or to disable them. I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't get that as much today.
Yeah, I don't get that many actual, like, phone calls or emails about it. But I know that when we did our information evening for this year and we explained the new deployment that we were doing with kids having their own Apple ID, but you don't have to put your credit card on it and so on. Well, one thing I pointed out to parents, I said, one of the things we're doing is by configuration, we're disabling in-app purchase. And the wave of relief that just went across everybody's face was just incredibly obvious and marked to me. And I think the British press in particular have really worked hard to kind of stoke the flames of this and make it a really big deal. And they've done a pretty good job of digging out the one person in the country whose kid spent £6,000 on in-app purchases. And I think, I'm not saying it's not a problem, but I think it's being made out to be more of a problem than it is. I have my own issues with in-app purchasing, but none of them are really about parents not knowing what their kids were spending. Yeah. I'm not so sure that in-app purchase is a good thing for iOS.
Well, I had some thoughts about that today, and I considered writing a blog post, and I realized it sounded dumb, so I deleted it. But I grew up playing video games way more than I should, and that was probably one of my biggest regrets of my childhood is playing. I mean, I'm talking back from the original Nintendo, and I stopped playing games at like the PlayStation 2, Xbox, and I never owned anything past that. And really, that was around the time my wife and I started dating. And not that once you become an adult, you don't play games. But I just was busy. I got busier. Like we were hanging out with my girlfriend. I was working full time. I was actually still in school. So I really stopped playing games. And then I got the iPad, and it had games on there. And I dabbled and played some games here and there. And I love this new trend of this, like these episode games, where like you can buy an episode of the game for $5. And, you know, I can play it, takes me an hour or two to beat, and then a couple months later, a new episode comes out. And I like that aspect of it, how I can buy mm-hmm. little chunks of the game. And so mm-hmm. that way, if the game starts to suck, I don't have to keep, paying for it or playing it. Because I'm weird in the fact that when I start something, like, I want to finish it. So if I start a game, mm-hmm. like, I want to beat it. And so in those aspects, I like it. But then when it's, like, a money grab, and, like, I'm dealing with this with my 3-year-old right now. Like, he'll... download, it looks like a, cool educational game. It'll be free. Okay, that's cool. Well, then it wants to charge like 99 cents for 50 things. And he wants all of them. And so it's like there's got to be a better balancing act. And I know a lot of that's a developer issue, but it's just, mm-hmm. it's bad. To me, it's bad for the ecosystem that these kind of things exist.
Yeah, I think it is too. It makes it feel very cheap and very low rent. I mean, we've been through kind of a similar thing with Beth, our middle daughter, who's 6. She got an iPad mini for Christmas, and she's got an Apple ID with, she can download games and so on. But because she doesn't have, like, a credit card, obviously, she's downloading free games. And what I'm constantly seeing from these games is just, like, full-screen adverts for other games coming up. So she's sitting playing a game, and then 2 minutes later, it's like, Dad, can I get this game? Because something else popped up. Can I get this game? And she's just, being pushed and pushed and pushed to get more and more games. All of which are, essentially clones of each other. There's so many unoriginal games involved here that it's kind of pathetic. And I don't know exactly what the answer is, but I think perhaps maybe giving her some kind of allowance to buy better games with actual money, if she can find any, that is, might be one solution. But yeah, that's one thing. There's the games with consumables or the episodic games, and then there's the free games that are constantly interrupting your play with adverts for other games, some kind of Ponzi scheme or something, I don't know. And then I think the worst of them all is that there are these games that are coming out where the entire mechanics of the game are based around you buying more in-app purchases. I don't know if you've played any recently. Real Racing 3 is probably the worst offender so far. I've seen other ones as well, but these kind of games where, like, there's an artificial delay put into the game that you can buy your way around, and Real Racing, it's, oh, your car's in for repair, you've got to wait 20 minutes of actual, wall clock time until you can race again, or you can pay these credits or whatever. I think it was John Gruber or somebody was complaining that there was one game where you, in order to complete the game, you essentially had to spend something like $60,000 on in-app purchases to actually finish the game. That feels pretty evil to me.
And it's sad because it cheapens what could be great games. Real Racing 3, let me pay $10 for it. And I, obviously, they've figured out the economics, and they're making money hand over fist. But to me, making a better game is just as important as making money. You know, and I think I talked about this a few weeks ago. I love Madden Football. I would pay $10 for that, $20 for that, $30 for that, for a stand-up Madden Football iPad game. The one that they released this year, you're unlocking playbooks. Like you don't even get plays until you pay money.
Yeah, and you're unlocking it with money, not with performance as well.
Well, and if they want to have a free download with an exhibition game, knock yourself out. Then let me say, oh, do you want to unlock the full game for $20, $10? Absolutely give people a taste of it. But there just doesn't need to be, like, and I don't know if the answer is like Apple says you can only have 10 in-app purchase categories or 10 in-app. You know, you don't want to, then there'll be more edge cases around that. But it's just frustrating when you feel like you're missing out on a cool game because the publisher or the developer is greedy.
Yes. I mean, I think I've never been to Las Vegas, but looking at the App Store and particularly the game section, that's what I imagine Las Vegas is like. A whole system designed for you to basically spend as much as you could possibly spend based on all kinds of incredibly sophisticated manipulations of your psychology in order to get you addicted, to get you interested, to keep you interested, to keep you playing, and to just suck more and more money out of your credit card. The worst thing about it, though, Bradley, I think, is that it's starting to affect actual proper apps that we want to use. You know, because we don't want to deploy some of these games. We don't want to deploy Candy Crush to our school iPads, but we do want to deploy GarageBand. We do want to deploy Paper by 53. We do want to deploy, you know, many, many apps that we see in the App Store. And our teachers go in and they look at them and they think, that's what's a great app. And it's free, you know. And more often I just find myself going back going, I'm sorry, you can't have that app because it's based on in-app purchases. It's not got any content until you, or it's got one thing until you pay them, you know. And I think that's my main concern is not that, I mean, games are games, but in fact, is this the future of all iOS applications? Free with in-app purchase?
Well, and there's no way for, you know, through managed distribution or redeemable codes to deploy in-app purchases. And, I mean, and we can say, okay, we should go bug the developer for something better, but when Apple's leading the charge with GarageBand, and what do you do there?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the thing, and I think education sales are not enough to justify for any developer, I don't think, really someone doing a lot of work to have like two different products in the store, one with in-app purchases and one full price. Although some developers, you know, I'm very grateful to them for doing that because it means we can use their apps, but overall, you know, are Paper by 53 going to put an education-specific version of their app and have all that hassle with customer confusion about which version they get? I'm pretty sure they're not. What can you do?
Well, and these are, I guess what you'd say, like the pre-adolescent years of iOS?
I guess so, yeah. I think it's another one of these cases where we're trying to make consumer technology fit in with a sort of organizational model where we don't necessarily want everybody to be buying their own software or having to pay for their own software. We want to provide it in a sort of coherent way. And we now have that for paid applications, just in time for paid applications to start to become the minority of applications. You know, I don't know if that's strictly true yet, but it certainly looks like that's the trend.
You know, one of the things that I would love to see Apple implement, and maybe they'll never will, is some sort of kids mode on iOS. You know, Netflix has this now, and it's actually pretty decent. And if you'd have told me 2 years ago that I'd be saying that, I would think you're crazy that I wanted to add something on top of iOS. But I've seen enough tweets from people I follow where their kids are playing a game on one of their iOS devices, and then they hit tweet your high score. You know, and things like that. And so I think about, like, if my son happened to grab my phone and was playing a game, or we were at dinner and he was getting cranky, I said, all right, play this game. he could like do some damage with my phone. And so should there be a way for a parent to say swipe up and hit a kid icon and it locks, you know, mail and Safari and messages and all those things, and you can only access this, you know, specified apps?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways you could argue that gated access is already that feature. You know, if your kid wants to play Angry Birds, you can just gated access, lock them into Angry Birds and be done with it. But I think the fundamental problem with a lot of these parental controls is that parents don't even know they're there. Whether that be, you know, requiring the password for every purchase, parents don't know that's a thing you can do. Or gated access, they think that's for disabled people. And in fact, it has broader applications as well. Well, and of course, gated access, the problem with gated access, both in the classroom and at home, is that it locks you into one app and not a bunch of apps.
Well, and exactly. And you think about it, like going back to my year sitting at dinner and your kid's getting cranky and you're trying to keep your other kid from crying. And you say, hey, son, here, just play one of your games. You're not going to remember to go into like turn on guided access. You're just going to hand on the phone and they're going to just go to town. I don't know. And again, I don't know. Does Apple want to add the complexity, or do they want to try to work around that to make it harder for kids to screw stuff up?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things you can certainly see is that Apple's competitors are doing it. You know, the Android is in some of the more recent versions has got kind of multi-user capability for tablets. And also you've got on the Kindle Fire, they've got Kindle Free Time or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it can schedule and manage like how much time the kids get to play games versus, you know, the usual middle class prejudice of, oh, you could read books forever, you know. In fact, the biggest issue I've ever had with my oldest daughter is how much time she spends reading books and how sometimes I've had to save her from trying to walk down the stairs while reading a book or walk out into traffic while reading a book. So unlimited book time is not safe for April either, unfortunately. But yeah, you know, the point being that other people are doing it, and presumably they're doing it as a differentiating feature, but also because people want it. And I know that one of the biggest kind of plaudits for the Kindle Fire HDX was the fact that it had this Kindle Free Time, and that was seen as something pretty useful for education, or for parents, really, maybe more than education. But again, does that translate into sales? I mean, at the end of the day, this is the question. Are people not buying an iPad because it doesn't have, you know, a kid mode? The numbers don't seem to suggest it. Of course, nobody knows how many Kindle Fires Amazon has sold. Maybe it's 5. Maybe it's 50 million. I don't know. But it's an interesting, both a design challenge and a marketing challenge. And the cynical amongst us would say that Apple just wants you to buy 2 iPads. And I'm not going to lie, that is actually the route I have chosen.
Parents upgrade, their kids get their older ones. And
yeah.
But to me, that model, when there are enough things you say, does that translate into sales? To me, you end up, that's a dangerous place to be in, because over time you become complacent about innovation. And where you, so if iOS is the dominant platform and they just kind of take the pedal off the gas a little bit to try to keep it simple and keep the status quo, if you change that wording to Windows, it sort of makes sense. Because when you're the dominant player, it becomes harder and harder to change things because people are so used to it.
Yes, and I think Apple has a bit of an institutional fear of it, but at the same time you could say, well, how is that playing out in iOS right now? When you look at iOS 7, you know, they radically changed the entire appearance of the operating system in one revision. You know, no half measures for Apple in that respect, no desktop mode, no iOS 6 mode for iOS 7. And I suppose that is representative for 2013 of Apple's fear of becoming stagnant and tied in. And I know, having read a lot of the views in times past were things like enterprise customers are the worst customers to have because they want everything, they're whiny, and they just tie you into the past. And I think there's a fair point to be made there, which is that somebody said to me the other day on Twitter, they said, iOS still feels like a good product that isn't designed for education. And my sort of retort to him was, well, that's why it's useful in education, because it wasn't designed for education. And I think if you look at things that are designed for education, they're very much just like the things education has always had. And I think that's probably why teachers are more interested in iPad now, is because it's not specifically just a locked-down, heavily rubberized, cartoonish kids' tablet. If you look at some of the kids' tablets that are in the market, I would hate to use one of them. So it's an interesting balance. You're right. It's between that innovation and between people like you and I not going insane whenever something changes. And I try not to. You know, I'm trying not to be a guy who's just like, oh, something changed, panic stations. But, you know, there are some changes that we've mentioned already that have actually affected the way people work, such as the change to the iWork file formats and so on.
Well, I just stick with it. Like with most things, there is an in-between that Apple often has to find, because now that they are the dominant player, it is hard to kind of rip the roots up every 12 months on everything, because so many businesses, so people have businesses that are built around iOS. And so if you rip up the roots every 12 months, it becomes difficult. But you also don't want to be Microsoft, where you're still providing software updates to an OS that came out in 2001.
Yeah. I was at the Genius Bar last night to get one of our iPads replaced. And I noticed that both the Genius Bar app that they use, and also the Easy Pay system that you use for swiping your credit card, both of those are still running iOS 6. Tells you something.
Yep.
You know, there's inertia building up behind this. And I don't know, are you a West Wing fan, Bradley?
I've always wanted to, but I never have.
There's a scene in one of the episodes where the president character, Bartlett, he has to make a decision whether or not he's going to kill a foreign dignitary who is actually a terrorist as well. And his chief of staff is trying to persuade him to do this act so that they can get rid of this guy who was planning to blow up the Golden Gate Bridge. And there's this conversation right at the end of an episode where Bartlett, the president, is telling Leo, the chief of staff, he's saying, you know, murder is just wrong. It's absolutely wrong. I can't get past this. And Leo says, well, yes, but you have to do it anyway. And Bartlett comes back and challenges him. He says, why do I have to do it? And he says, because you won. And I think that's where Apple is right now, is that they don't want to give a roadmap. They don't want to give a two-year plan or a life cycle promise or a guarantee of support. But in some ways, I think they're almost at that point now where they have to because they won. And Microsoft had to do it because they won back in the day, and Microsoft did do it. And I think that's the challenge for Apple right now, is how does Apple go from being that scrappy 1% of the market insurgent company who can just throw Hail Mary and try and change the world with the iPhone, and that actually worked, and now there's, you know, trillions of dollars of business built around their products, and what do they do because they won? And that's the tricky question right now.
Yes.
So there you go, a West Wing reference. Have we done one before?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think I've done a West Wing reference before. Been a 30 Rock reference. Stretching my legs in American culture.
A week doesn't go by that I don't at least send one 30 Rock animated GIF and a Seinfeld one as well. To somebody.
It's always the one with Liz Lemon going, nerd rage.
Or I love the one, Shut It Down, Dealbreaker. That's my favorite.
Yeah, that's a classic. Can I just say that VPN? I was teaching VPN the other day, and I was like, in years past, we teach kids VPN, they don't know what VPN is, but now they know what VPN is. And do you know why? American Netflix.
True.
Yep. Sorry, you were going to
say. I was going to say, like, if any of our listeners have never watched 30 Rock, that would be a wise use of your weekend.
Yeah, you're going to want some adult diapers, or just take your tablet into the bathroom. But if you can just end to end the weekend, there's all seven series are now on Netflix, and good for laughs.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's like all the modern technology we have, and then you. Like, I have to wait 2 weeks to watch Sherlock when it, like, you know, on PBS. because it's not made in America, and then you can't see 30 Rock on Netflix. It's like, what are we doing here, folks? Is this the best we can do here? I mean, like, why are you having a VPN to be able to watch a show that is no longer even on the air?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not even current. It's just like, because reasons and lawyers and money and stuff. I wanted to mention one other thing just about, in-app purchases and kids on the iTunes store and so on, which is something most people don't know about. Are you aware of iTunes allowances?
I have heard of it, but I've never used it.
I've been looking into setting up for my kids, and what it is basically you can set up a recurring charge to your Apple ID to send a gift card, or just, I think it's actually just an automatic credit, like the recipient doesn't even have to do anything, it just gets credited to their account of £5 or £10 or whatever a month. But that's quite a good way to send money to somebody on a regular basis without necessarily having to like go and buy a gift card every time, is to set up an iTunes allowance. I think the only way you can do it is through iTunes on the desktop. I don't think there's any way on iOS to do it, but that's something to look into as well. So, do you want to wrap up the show? We've kind of gone long in a lot of that stuff, which is great. I'm happy with that. Some listener feedback.
Yeah.
I'm going to do some listener feedback. Yeah. Okay. So, first thing, David Cummings writes asking about research tools on iPad. And he says, with three kids currently in grades 9 to 12, I'm interested in whether or not you have formulated an opinion on research tools for the iPad or Mac, if this isn't straying too far out of your respective lanes, he says. He says that he's listened to Mac power users and reading sites like the Sweet Setup has yielded bits and pieces of the solution, but he was asking if we were going to cover any software tools for research, and is that the kind of thing that we're interested in talking about? And I certainly think it is, Bradley. What about you?
Yeah, because I think there's some powerful tools on the desktop for this. Mm-hmm. And depending on when you say research tools, a lot of it, that's a broad topic. But like I can immediately think of something like Scrivener for iPad, that where you can collect information that you can then use in your writing. And so I think there's certainly, there's not one app that jumps out and says this is kind of like the be-all, end-all single app for this. I could name about five apps that would be handy in this today.
I think you can build a good workflow. But I agree with you that there's not necessarily just one app that's going to do end-to-end everything you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, you could say, okay, Evernote's a part of it, Dropbox could be a part of it, something like PDF Expert could be a part of it, which I'll tell you, if you've never bought that app, that is one of the best apps on the iPad. A friend of mine, he has written a novel, and I'm helping him edit it and reading through it, and that is just a marvelous app. It's a side note. But
definitely.
I don't know if the fact that, when you say there's not a single app, but there's a workflow you could build, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And if it's a bad thing, is that Apple's problem or is that developer problem?
Yeah, I think that's something that it could be a wee bit of both. And we've talked long and hard, and I don't want to go into it again, about the kind of things that we think iOS needs to get more powerful. And I think research is one of those areas where having a bit more inter-app communication in iOS could get a lot more powerful. I just speak personally, what do I do for research? Well, I primarily use Evernote for almost everything. When I see links going by either on the web or on Twitter, I will use Safari Reading List to save those. That's my Read Later service now. I don't use Instapaper or Pocket anymore. I'm using Safari Reader just because it's built into everything, and the Safari sidebar on the Mac is really nice. But then when I read something that I want to keep, I will clip it to Evernote. And a lot of the stuff that I do, because in education, PDF is kind of the lingua franca for a lot of files rather than the web itself, because a lot of people producing these documents are still mired in Word and Office rather than using something a little more modern like the web. What I'll do is I'll clip those PDFs to Evernote and then use Evernote's markup tools, which are good but still quite clunky in some respects, in that you have to go into a different view to go and edit it, to mark up the PDF rather than just viewing it. So there's a viewing mode and a markup mode, and they're separate on Evernote, which I think would be much better if they were unified. So that's mainly what I do. And for actually working with PDF forms and things like that, I'll use PDF Expert and Dropbox together as well. But most of my actual research ends up in Evernote, in just one massive big notebook called Research. And then I've got three or four tags for major topics that I'm kind of tracking over a long time, such as knowledge work, self-driving cars is another thing I'm interested in, education topics, you know, mobile working, things like that. So that's kind of my workflow, is primarily Evernote, and most of it just goes in and is stored, and then I look at it through either their appearance in related notes or showing up as I search the web as well.
Yeah, mine is very similar. Yeah, and I think the reason I stick so heavily to Evernote is because of how great it is on, you know, iOS.
Yeah.
You know, I use, you know, links. I use Pocket. You know, a lot of things. You know, if it is, I have a Pinboard account, but I don't use it. I'm like you. If it's something, if it's an article I want to keep, I will use the Safari Evernote Web Clipper and save it into Evernote. And I have actually a stack called Bookmarks, and there's various kind of different things under there, like business, leadership, productivity, even quotes that I find that are good, technology, mm-hmm. things like that. I'll have some stuff in Dropbox. Like right now, I have a lot of my tax stuff in Dropbox that I've exported back out of Evernote, mainly because I have to send it to my accountant soon, and I wasn't sure if he used Evernote or not. But it would have been nice to share a notebook with him. That would have been nice. So, you know, I think it's no surprise that cloud services obviously, like, you know, are a lot of these things, because you know a lot of my research I might do on my iPad, or I might do it on my phone when I'm, you know, out and about, or, you know, trying to rock my son to sleep. I'll catch up on articles, and I think that's why companies like Evernote and Dropbox are so set up well for the future, because they become not really just an app but a backbone. You know, it's specifically with Dropbox, it's not even, you know, if you do your writing in Byword, and if you know, when Dropbox becomes more than just a folder that syncs on your Mac, and it becomes a syncing engine for you for your apps, and you don't even think about the Dropbox for iOS app, and that's a powerful place for Dropbox to be in.
Yeah, definitely. And you see that in apps like PDF Expert, where they can actually kind of transparently use Google Drive and Dropbox as back ends and sync folders to and from them, rather than having to always like download something from Dropbox into that app. And I asked some of the people at Riedel whether or not they were going to support Evernote as a backend. They said there were some issues with the way Evernote stores files as attachments and notes. They made it a little more difficult, but they were trying to gauge interest in that. So if anyone else out there like me would love PDF Expert to be your markup tool for Evernote, drop those people an email and try and see if we can get them to build in Evernote backend support as well.
Yeah, adding that to my to-do list, because I would love to see, because I store most of my PDFs in Evernote, and a lot of things I'll mainly just export out into Dropbox. You know, I most day-to-day I use the Documents app. Yeah, for heavy markup I'm using PDF Expert, but for just reading I use the Documents app, and I'd love to be able just to leave that stuff in Evernote. But yeah, it's awesome. It's just, you know, it just looks like a folder. You don't even know that it's Dropbox or Google Drive. It works well.
Definitely. Okay, so next question comes from Eric Abelson, who refers back to our show about caching server and is recommending that people look into using virtualization as a way to deploy caching server rather than having dedicated hardware for it. He says, looking at some of the virtualization options available today to consolidate some of the basic infrastructure functions onto a single machine. He talks about running ESXi on a Mac Mini, which will let you run several VMs, including OS X, since if you're running on Apple hardware, that's within the license. IMAX 2, but ESXi, he says, is designed for headless use, and you'd be wasting a screen just using iMac. So it's interesting that feedback came in, because I actually, over the course of a couple of weeks ago, to free up a Mac Mini for something else, took our caching server and moved on to a VMware Fusion instance running on the same machine that we run our Apple configurator stuff on. So that machine's sitting there idle for most of the week. So I threw on VMware and put a Maverick server inside that, and been running our caching server inside that as well. And it has worked quite well so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of options there, and a lot depends on your usage and what kind of load you're putting on it. I mean, obviously, Your school is different from a K-12 that has 3,000 students. And so, you know, if one of the things, if you're not familiar with that, even if you have the idea of what you want to do and what you want to, you know, work, you know, use it for, it might be good to kind of consult with one of your VARs, you know, on that. And side note on VARs, you know, if you don't know what VAR stands for, it stands for Value Added Reseller. So mm-hmm. there's nothing that keeps me from buying the majority of my stuff, retail, Amazon, Newegg. Like, and so if I buy something from a VAR, I am doing that for some sort of value. Mm-hmm. I bought a printer yesterday, a not cheap printer, a $500 printer. And so I called, you know, I had been, you know, goofing off on Amazon looking for a printer, and one of my VARs emailed me and said, "Hey, you got anything you need to bid on?" I said, "Hey, I got a printer I need. I have one feature it needs to do. It needs to obviously be a network scanner, you know, like a network printer." I said, I need it to have the ability to scan the PDF to an email address on the device." I said, "I need PC or Mac free scanning. I want to be able to plug in an SMTP server, plug it, you know, add my own little address book. I'm not even wanting mm-hmm. like LDAP integration. I just want to be able to say these email addresses scan." He said, "Oh, I got a great option for you. It's this one. It's been discontinued, but it's a great model." It's awesome. Send it my way. It does not have that. It requires you to, like, you can scan to email, but you have to initiate the scan on the computer. So you hit scan to email. You then have to go put the thing on the scanner, hit continue. It scans it back. Then it wants to open your mail client.
No.
This person's using Google Apps. It's like, what are we doing here, guys? I mean, it's like, and he says, well, if you try calling HP support. It's like, if I wanted to, you know, I told him, and I'm a nice guy, and I'm not hard on vendors. I like to be friends with my vendors. But I said, "Hey, man, if I wanted to, like, dink around with HP support and look in their support documentation, I would just bought it from Amazon and got it for cheaper." I mean, and not being rude, but, like, if you work for a VAR, like, your job is to make the people you, like, your customers easier. Because, again, you're a value add. You're reselling stuff yes. they can buy elsewhere. You are a value add. So provide that value. So he said, yes. "Do you want to return it?" "Well, yeah, I want to return it. It doesn't do the one feature that it needed."
"Do you want to return the thing that we misdescribed to you?"
Well, he sure. He said,
"Are you sure?"
He said, "Oh," he said, "it was my HP team that, you know, gave me the wrong information." That's not my problem. Mm-hmm. Like, you should be screaming at them that, you know, they, because I know I can send it back, and there's a different model they can sell us that costs $100 more, and that's fine. I've already deployed it.
Yep.
Because I assumed it did that. So,
and more fool you. That's what they say.
And rant.
Yeah, there are plenty of rants to be made about resellers. No question. Okay. Next thing is Diane Schneider writes to us, and she says she would appreciate knowing more on the audio app for iPad or iPhone and USB microphones. She was looking for a lapel one for students to record presentations. She has the same problem that I mentioned a couple of shows back about the inbuilt microphone on iOS devices being poor, whether at least for long-range recording. She says she didn't know the native video. She didn't know whether or not the native video app could take other input. And my answer to that is, when I was doing this, what we were doing is we were recording videos of kids doing presentations, and then we would record their second presentation and then the third presentation. But the thing we learned from the first one was that the built-in phone app, the phone microphone, wasn't good enough. So there was an app that we ended up using called Filmic Pro. That's F-I-L-M-I-C Pro. And connecting into the iPhone, actually, the USB connection kit, the camera connection kit with a lightning adapter, and then plugging a USB microphone into that. I was just using the Samsung Meteor microphone, the same one that we use sometimes to record the show when we're using iOS. And that worked fine. Filmic Pro is actually able to use external microphones to record the audio track to go along with the video that it captures as well. So that was the app that we ended up using. The built-in iOS video app will not use an external microphone, at least not a USB-connected microphone. There are some microphones you can get which are, you plug into the headphone jack, and obviously that will record the same way that your iPhone headphones would record. That works fine. And I think, is it Rode? R-O-D-E? They make a thing called the Smart Lav. It's a lavalier microphone, a lapel microphone, And it's very, very cheap. I think it's about £40 or so. And that just plugs in with a 3.5mm jack into the headphone socket of an iPhone or an iPad. And that's quite good if you're reasonably close up. But if you're doing something at further distance, you may want to put a longer USB cable on and pick it up that way. So that's just some more detail on that one in particular.
And we'll have a link to the app and the two products that we mentioned there in the show notes.
Yeah, great. The last piece of feedback I want to do is we're actually going to drop in an audio clip from a nice correspondent who just, well, she was kind enough to actually just record. She's a podcaster herself, her name's Alison. She recorded a little audio clip for us, and this is the first time anybody's ever done that, so I thought we would drop it into the show. She's referring back to some points that we were talking about quite a few shows ago now about how do you decide who to hire? Do you hire somebody for, I think it was actually their last user feedback show, do you hire somebody who has an educational background but has to learn the tech, or do you hire somebody who knows the tech but has to kind of find an interest in education after you hire them? So we're just going to run that little clip just now, and then we'll just follow up on that.
Hi, Fraser and Bradley. I was just listening to episode 62, where a listener wrote in asking a couple of interesting questions. One was whether to hire an educator who could learn IT or an IT person who could learn education. I was really influenced by a book called First Break All the Rules. It was written by the Gallup poll people who did this massive study, and what they determined was that you need to focus on your hiring for talent, not for skills. So in your case, you want to hire the talent you're looking for might be compassion or empathy, those kinds of things. Skills would be iOS knowledge, MDM knowledge, that kind of thing. Like Fraser said, you can teach those things. You can't teach someone to care. I would also look for in talents with any sysadmin would be systematic problem solving. That is something you learn with a technical education, so I always tended towards that because I knew I would get systematic problem solving. The real trick here is to figure out what questions to ask to find out whether you're going to get the right kind of person. If you need someone to use Excel, the question you might ask is, how do they organize their taxes? Because you can teach somebody to be to use Excel, but you can't teach them to be organized. So I don't know if you see the difference there. The other part of the question was whether you should hire somebody dedicated to you or part of a corporation that does that. I have a really strong opinion on this, too. The danger in hiring a solo person is they have nobody to learn from. They sit alone in your organization. You might think that they're greatest sysadmin in the whole world and they know everything. But if they're not learning from anybody, then they don't. Pretty soon, they're going to become stale. So the talent to look for there, if you're going to hire solo, is whether they're social. Do they read forums and help other people and learn from other people? And whether they're willing to go to classes and go to user groups and learn from each other, that kind of thing. If you do go to a big company, there is a way to do it correctly. You want to make sure the contract is written that they work for you as though they're an employee, not a cookie-cutter cost-saving contract like what Fraser was talking about. I've seen it done both ways, and I know which one works, and it's one where they work for you, but you can also get rid of them if they're bad, or they can bring in other people who have better talents than they do, or skills, I should say, in a particular subject. Anyway, that's my two cents. This is Allison Sheridan from the NoSillaCast podcast.
So Bradley, I think there's some really good points in that little clip there. I think she makes some very clear arguments, and I think it would be good to put a link to that book that she mentions in the show notes as well. Yeah, great. So Allison, thank you very much for that. And if anybody else wants to send us an audio clip, we'll listen to it. And if you, as long as you're not using the iPhone headphones, if you can use a decent mic, we'll think about dropping it into the show. So that's all the feedback I have just now, Bradley. We're just coming up on an hour, and I think we have complained about many things. We have hoped for the future. We have observed on what might come, what could come, and also in-app purchases.
Oh, I have one final thing. I think I've mentioned in the past that I, Love logged me in, and they have their remote desktop mm-hmm. service, and they have had a great free option for years if you just need a basic remote desktop. It's really, really simple. It kind of didn't require any port forwarding on your firewalls. It was really, really easy. Mm-hmm. So the free one's going away, which is a shame. It's like $69 a year for the paid one, which it's if you just need it for like here and there, it's kind of expensive mm-hmm. to keep. So I've kind of migrated to Screens VNC for that. It works really well. I think it's $20 for iOS, and they have a Mac version that's $30. I don't really need the Mac version because I mainly just want to be able to get back to my Mac occasionally from iOS. They also have a thing called Screens Connect that you can install on the Mac that makes it easier to kind of connect to it. You don't have to go in and forward, basically like set up a, port forwarding in your router and things like that. Just kind of, as long as it can get to the port, then it works. So we'll put a link to Screens in the show notes. So if you're a Log Me In user, sorry about that.
Yeah, we've got a solution for you on that one. I also recently started using Screens Connect. I think it was sort of over Christmas. I'd been using iTeleport before. And iTeleport also has a Kinect type app where it will figure out where your other devices are and route you to them. But a big flaw in the design of iTeleport Kinect is that for some reason, and heaven knows why, they want to use your Gmail credentials as the way in which they connect you to other devices. So you put in your Gmail username and password into iTeleport Kinect, and then you put it into the app, and somehow it uses your Gmail to find it. And I don't know why I ever thought that was okay, but I did. And, more and more, I was like, well, I don't think I'm doing that anymore. And Adovia have their own account system, so it's completely separate. You can have a unique password, and that seems a whole lot more hygienic, shall we say.
Oh, I agree. I had an employee come by this week, and she said, she had 50 emails in her inbox where she had obviously logged into something that was, basically she'd been phished with her work Gmail account, and it was trying to spam out through her. Well, it was bouncing back. And so she basically had all these undeliverable messages. Well, that's because she was spamming essentially. So we had to change her password. Yes. Of course, they always swear they didn't do it. I mean, they just, I didn't log in anything. I haven't done anything. It's like, it's like the server forgot your password. It's like, and the server doesn't forget your password. I mean, you forgot your password. It's okay, but just please don't blame the machine.
Yeah, no, that right there is the perfect argument for two-factor authentication.
Yes.
Yep. And I suppose at some level, users who have been very expertly phished might not even know they've been phished. Because she might think that all she's ever done is log into Gmail. I just didn't think to look for the green bar in the URL or whatever. So, yeah, phishing's a pain. I was teaching about that the other day as well, part of our e-safety program. But it was funny, the program we were using was it was for sort of 10-year-olds, and it was all about, when your bank account could be phished and your social security number and stuff. And these kids are like, bank account? Do I have a bank account? So I was trying to come up with examples that were a little more relevant, like your Moshi Monsters account or your Instagram for that matter, which is the one all the kids are into now. Okay, so let us leave it there this week, Bradley. Next week we shall chat about some new things that we're planning for the beginning part of the year. I hope it's something that people will find useful. And I'll catch up with you next week.
So have a good week, everybody.